rain, Cash says. Pa looks at him, his face streaming slowly. It is as though upon a face carved by a savage caricaturist, a monstrous burlesque of all bereavement flowed. You go on in, Cash says. Me and Vernon can finish it. Pa looks at them. The sleeves of Jewel's coat are too short for him. Upon his face, the rain streams, slow as cold glycerin. I don't begrudge her the wedding, he says. He moves again and falls to shifting the planks, picking them up, laying them down again carefully, as though they are glass. He goes to the lantern and pulls at the propped raincoat until he knocks it down, and Cash comes and fixes it back. You get onto the house, Cash says. He leads Pa to the house and returns with the raincoat and folds it and places it beneath the shelter where the lantern sits. Vernon is not stopped. He looks up, still sawing. You ought to done that at first, he says. You knowed it was fixing to rain. It's his fever, Cash says. He looks at the board. Aye, Vernon says. He'd have come anyway. Cash squints at the board. On the long flank of it, the rain crashes steadily, myriad, fluctuant. I'm going to bevel it, he says. It'll take more time, Vernon says. Cash sets the plank on edge. A moment longer, Vernon watches him. Then he hands him the plane. Vernon holds the board steady while Cash bevels the edge of it with the tedious and minute care of a jeweler. Mrs. Tull comes to the edge of the porch and calls Vernon. How near are you done? She says. Vernon does not look up. Not long. Some yet. She watches Cash stooping at the plank, the turgid, savage gleam of the lantern slicking on the raincoat as he moves. You go down and get some planks off the barn and finish it, and come in out of the rain, she says. You'll both catch your death. Vernon does not move. Vernon, she says. We won't be long, he says. We'll be done after a spell. Mrs. Tull watches them a while. Then she re-enters the house. If we get in a tight, we could take some of them planks, Vernon says. I'll help you put them back. Cash ceases the plane and squints along the plank, wiping it with his palm. Give me the next one, he says. Sometime toward dawn, the rain ceases. But it is not yet day when Cash drives the last nail and stands stiffly up and looks down at the finished coffin, the others watching him. In the lantern light, his face is calm, musing. Slowly he strokes his hands on his raincoated thighs in a gesture deliberate, final, and composed. Then the four of them, Cash and Pa and Vernon and Peabody, raise the coffin to their shoulders and turn toward the house. It is light, yet they move slowly. Empty, yet they carry it carefully. Lifeless, yet they move with hushed precautionary words to one another, speaking of it as though, complete, it now slumbered lightly alive, waiting to come awake. On the dark floor, their feet clump awkwardly, as though for a long time they have not walked on floors. They set it down by the bed. Peabody says quietly, Let's eat a snack. It's almost daylight. Where's Cash? He has returned to the trestles, stooped again in the lantern's feeble glare as he gathers up his tools and wipes them on a cloth carefully and puts them into the box with its leather sling to go over the shoulder. Then he takes up box, lantern, and raincoat and returns to the house, mounting the steps into faint silhouette against the paling east. In a strange room, you must empty yourself for sleep. And before you are emptied for sleep, what are you? And when you are emptied for sleep, you are not. And when you are filled with sleep, You never were. I don't know what I am. I don't know if I am or not. Jewel knows he is, because he does not know that he does not know whether he is or not. He cannot empty himself for sleep, because he is not what he is, and he is what he is not. Beyond the unlamped wall, I can hear the rain shaping the wagon that is ours, the load that is no longer theirs that felled and sawed it, nor yet theirs that bought it, and which is not ours either. Lie on our wagon, though it does, since only the wind and the rain shape it only to Jewel and me that are not asleep. And since sleep is not, and rain and wind are was, it is not. Yet the wagon is, because when the wagon is was, Addie Bundren will not be. And Jewel is, so Addie Bundren must be. And then I must be, or I could not empty myself for sleep in a strange room. And so, if I am not emptied yet, I am is. How often have I lain beneath rain on a strange roof, thinking of home?
Cash. I made it on the bevel. Number one, there's more surface for the nails to grip. Number two, there's twice the gripping surface to each seam. Number three, the water will have to seep into it on a slant. Water moves easiest up and down or straight across. Number four, in a house, people are upright two-thirds of the time, so the seams and joints are made up and down, because the stress is up and down. Number five. In a bed where people lie down all the time, the joints and seams are made sideways, because the stress is sideways. Number six, except. Number seven, a body is not square like a cross tie. Number eight, animal magnetism. Number nine, the animal magnetism of a dead body makes the stress come slanting, so the seams and joints of a coffin are made on the bevel. Number ten, you can see by an old grave that the earth sinks down on the bevel. Number 11, while in a natural hole it sinks by the center, the stress being up and down. Number 12, so I made it on the bevel. Number 13, it makes a neater job.
End of Disc 2, Disc 3.
Vardaman. My mother is a fish. Tull. It was 10 o'clock when I got back, with Peabody's team hitched onto the back of the wagon. They'd already dragged the buckboard back from where Quick found it upside down straddle of the ditch about a mile from the spring. It was pulled out of the road at the spring, and about a dozen wagons was already there. It was Quick found it. He said the river was up and still rising. He said it had already covered the highest water mark on the bridge piling he had ever seen. That bridge won't stand a whole lot of water, I said. Has somebody told Ants about it? I told him, Quick said. He says he reckons them boys is heard and unloaded and are on the way back by now. He says they can load up and get across. He better go on and bury her at New Hope, Armstead said. That bridge is old. I wouldn't monkey with it. His mind is set on taking her to Jefferson, Quick said. Then he better get at it soon as he can, Armstead said. Ants meets us at the door. He is shaved, but not good. There is a long cut on his jaw, and he is wearing his Sunday pants and a white shirt with the neckband buttoned. It is drawn smooth over his hump, making it look bigger than ever, like a white shirt will. And his face is different, too. He looks folks in the eye now, dignified. his face tragic and composed, shaking us by the hand as we walk up onto the porch and scrape our shoes, a little stiff in our Sunday clothes. Our Sunday clothes rustling, not looking full at him as he meets us. The Lord giveth, we say. The Lord giveth. That boy is not there. Peabody told about how he come into the kitchen, hollering, swarming and clawing at Cora when he found her cooking that fish, and how Dewey Dell taking him down to the barn. My team all right? Peabody says. All right, I tell him. I give them a bait this morning. Your buggy seems all right, too. It ain't hurt. And no fault of somebody's, he says. I'd give a nickel to know where that boy was when that team broke away. If it's broke anywhere, I'll fix it, I say. The women folks go on into the house. We can hear them talking and fanning. The fans go whish, 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 and them talking, the talking sounding kind of like bees murmuring in a water bucket. The men stop on the porch, talking some, not looking at one another. Howdy, Vernon, they say. Howdy, Tull. Looks like more rain. It does for a fact. Yes, sir, it will rain some more. It come up quick. And going away slow, it don't fail. I go around to the back. Cash is filling up the holes he bored in the top of it. He is trimming out plugs for them, one at a time, the wood wet and hard to work. He could cut up a tin can and hide the holes and nobody wouldn't know the difference. Wouldn't mind, anyway. I have seen him spend an hour trimming out a wedge like it was glass he was working, when he could have reached around and picked up a dozen sticks and drove them into the joint and made it do. When we finished, I go back to the front. The men have gone a little piece from the house, sitting on the ends of the boards and on the sawhorses where we made it last night, some sitting and some squatting. Whitfield ain't come yet. They look up at me, their eyes asking. It's about, I say. He's ready to nail. While they're getting up, Ants comes to the door and looks at us and we return to the porch. We scrape our shoes again, careful, waiting for one another to go in first, milling a little at the door. Ant stands inside the door, dignified, composed. He waves us in and leads the way into the room. They had laid her in it reversed. Cash made it clock-shaped, like this, with every joint and seam beveled and scrubbed with the plane, tight as a drum and neat as a sewing basket. And they had laid her in it head to foot so it wouldn't crush her dress. It was her wedding dress, and it had a flare-out bottom. And they had laid her head to foot in it so the dress could spread out. And they had made her a veil out of a mosquito bar so the auger holes in her face wouldn't show. When we are going out, Whitfield comes. He is wet and muddy to the waist coming in. The Lord comfort this house, he says. I was late because the bridge has gone. I went down to the old ford and swum my horse over, the Lord protecting me. His grace be upon this house. We go back to the trestles and plank ends and sit or squat. I knowed it would go, Armstead says. It's been there a long time, that ere bridge, Quick says. The Lord has kept it there, you mean? Uncle Billy says. I don't know e'er a man that's touched hammer to it in 25 years. How long has it been there, Uncle Billy? Quick says. It was built in, let me see, it was in the year 1888, Uncle Billy says. I mind it because the first man to cross it was Peabody coming to my house when Jody was born.
If I'd have crossed it every time your wife littered since, it'd have been wore out long before this, Billy, Peabody says.
We laugh, suddenly loud, then suddenly quiet again. We look a little aside at one another. Lots of folks has crossed it that won't cross no more bridges, Houston says. It's a fact, Little John says. It's so. One more ain't no ways, Armstead says. It'd take them 2-3 days to got her to town in the wagon. They'd be gone a week, getting her to Jefferson and back. What's Aunt so itching to take her to Jefferson for anyway? Houston says. He promised her, I say. She wanted it. She come from there. Her mind was set on it. And Aunt's is set on it too, Quick says.
Hey, Uncle Billy says. It's like a man that's let everything slide all his life to get set on something that will make the most trouble for everybody he knows. Well, it'll take the Lord to get her over that river now, Peabody says. Ants can't do it.
And I reckon he will, Quick says. He's took care of Ants a long time now. It's a fact, Little John says. Too long to quit now, Armstead says.
I reckon he's like everybody else around here, Uncle Billy says. He's done it so long now, he can't quit.
Cash comes out. He has put on a clean shirt, his hair wet, his comb smooth down on his brow, smooth and black as if he had painted it onto his head. He squats stiffly among us, we watching him. You feeling this weather, ain't you? Armstead says. Cash says nothing. A broke bone always feels it, Little John says. A fella with a broke bone can tell it a-coming. Lucky Cash got off with just a broke leg, Armstead says. He might have hurt himself bedrid. How far'd you fall, Cash?
28 foot. 4.5 inches about, Cash says.
I move over beside him. A fellow can show slip quick on wet planks, Quick says. It's too bad, I say, but you couldn't help it.
It's them darn women, he says. I made it to balance with her. I made it to her measure and weight.
If it takes wet boards for folks to fall, it's fixin' to be lots of fallin' before the spell is done.
You couldn't have hoped it, I say.
I don't mind the folks fallin'. It's the cotton and corn I mind. Neither does Peabody mind the folks fallin'. How about it, Doc? It's a fact. Washed clean out in the ground it will be. Seems like something is always happening to it. Course it does. That's why it's worth anything. If nothing didn't happen and everybody made a big crop, do you reckon it would be worth the raising? Well, I'd be darned if I'd like to see my work washed out in the ground, work I sweat over. It's a fact. A fellow wouldn't mind seeing it washed up if he could just turn on the rain himself. Who is that man can do that? Where's the color of his eyes?
Eh, the Lord made it to grow. It's his'n to wash up if he sees it fitting so.
You couldn't have hoped it, I say.
It's them darn women, he says.
In the house, the women begin to sing. We hear the first line commence, beginning to swell as they take hold, and we rise and move toward the door, taking off our hats and throwing our shoes away. We do not go in. We stop at the steps, clumped, holding our hats between our lax hands in front or behind, standing with one foot advanced and our heads lowered, looking aside, down at our hats and our hands, and at the earth or now and then at the sky, and at one another's grave, composed face. The song ends. The voices quaver away with a rich and dying fall. Whitfield begins. His voice is bigger than him. It's like they are not the same. It's like he is one, and his voice is one, swimming on two horses side by side across the ford and coming into the house, the mud-splashed one and the one that never even got wet, triumphant and sad. Somebody in the house begins to cry. It sounds like her eyes and her voice were turned back inside her, listening. We move, shifting to the other leg, meeting one another's eye and making like they hadn't touched. Whitfield stops at last. The women sing again. In the thick air, it's like their voices come out of the air, flowing together and on in the sad, comforting tunes. When they cease, it's like they hadn't gone away. It's like they had just disappeared into the air. And when we moved, we would loose them again out of the air around us, sad and comforting. Then they finish, and we put on our hats, our movements stiff, like we hadn't never wore hats before. On the way home, Cora is still singing. I am bounding toward my God and my reward, she sings, sitting on the wagon, the shawl around her shoulders and the umbrella open over her, though it is not raining. She has Hearn, I say. Wherever she went, she has her reward in being free of Anse Bundren. She laid there 3 days in that box, waiting for Dahl and Jewel to come clean back home and get a new wheel and go back to where the wagon was in the ditch. Take my team, Anse, I said. We'll wait for Aon, he said. She'll want it so. She was ever a particular woman. On the third day, they got back and they loaded her into the wagon and started, and it already too late. You'll have to go all the way round by Samson's Bridge. It'll take you a day to get there. Then you'll be 40 miles from Jefferson. Take my team, Anse. We'll wait for Aon. She'll want it so. It was about a mile from the house we saw him, sitting on the edge of the slough. It hadn't had a fish in it, never that I knowed. He looked around at us, his eyes round and calm, his face dirty, the pole across his knees. Cora was still singing. This ain't no good day to fish, I said. You come on home with us, and me and you'll go down to the river first thing in the morning and catch some fish. It's one in here, he said. Dewey Dell seen it. You come on with us. The river's the best place. It's in here, he said. Dewey Dell seen it. I'm bounding toward my God and my reward, Cora sung.
Darl. It's not your horse that's dead, Jewel, I say. He sits erect on the seat, leaning a little forward, wooden-backed. The brim of his hat is soaked free of the crown in two places, drooping across his wooden face so that, head lowered, he looks through it, like through the visor of a helmet, looking long across the valley to where the barn leans against the bluff, shaping the invisible horse. See them? I say. High above the house, against the quick, thick sky, they hang in narrowing circles. From here, they are no more than specks, implacable, patient, portentous. But it's not your horse that's dead. God damn you, he says. God damn you. I cannot love my mother because I have no mother. Jules' mother is a horse. Motionless, the tall buzzards hang in soaring circles, the clouds giving them an illusion of retrograde. Motionless, wooden-backed, wooden-faced, he shapes the horse in a rigid stoop like a hawk, hook-winged. They are waiting for us, ready for the moving of it, waiting for him. He enters the stall and waits until it kicks at him so that he can slip past and mount onto the trough and pause, peering out across the intervening stall tops toward the empty path before he reaches into the loft. God damn him! God damn him!
Cash. It won't balance. If you wanted to tote and ride on a balance, we will have pick up. God damn you, pick up. I'm telling you, it won't tote and it won't ride on a balance unless pick up. Pick up, god damn your thick-nosed soul to hell. Pick up. It won't balance. If they wanted to tote and ride on a balance, they will have...
Darl. He stoops among us above it, two of the eight hands. In his face, the blood goes in waves. In between them, his flesh is greenish-looking, about that smooth, thick, pale green of cow's cud, his face suffocated, furious, his lip lifted upon his teeth. Pick up, he says. Pick up, goddamn your thick-nosed soul. He heaves, lifting one whole side so suddenly that we all spring into the lift to catch and balance it before he hurls it completely over. For an instant it resists, as though volitional, as though within it her pole-thin body clings furiously, even though dead, to a sort of modesty, as she would have tried to conceal a soiled garment that she could not prevent her body soiling. Then it breaks free, rising suddenly, as though the emaciation of her body had added buoyancy to the planks, or as though, seeing that the garment was about to be torn from her, she rushes suddenly after it in a passionate reversal that flouts its own desire and need. Jules' face goes completely green, and I can hear teeth in his breath. We carry it down the hall, our feet harsh and clumsy on the floor, moving with shuffling steps, and through the door. Steady it a minute now, Pa says, letting go. He turns back to shut and lock the door, but Jewel will not wait. Come on, he says in that suffocating voice. Come on! We lower it carefully down the steps. We move, balancing it as though it were something infinitely precious, our faces averted, breathing through our teeth to keep our nostrils closed. We go down the path, toward the slope. We better wait, Cash says. I tell you it ain't balanced now. We'll need another hand on that hill. Then turn loose, Jewel says. He will not stop. Cash begins to fall behind, hobbling to keep up, breathing harshly. Then he is distanced, and Jewel carries the entire front end alone, so that, tilting as the path begins to slant, it begins to rush away from me and slip down the air like a sled upon invisible snow, smoothly evacuating atmosphere in which the sense of it is still shaped. Wait, Jewel, I say. But he will not wait. He is almost running now, and Cash is left behind. It seems to me that the end which I now carry alone has no weight, as though it coasts like a rushing straw upon the furious tide of Jewel's despair. I am not even touching it when, turning, he lets it overshoot him, swinging, and stops it and sloughs it into the wagon bed in the same motion, and looks back at me, his face suffused with fury and despair. God damn you. God damn you.
Vardaman. We are going to town. Dewey Dell says it won't be sold because it belongs to Santa Claus, and he'd taken it back with him until next Christmas. Then it will be behind the glass again, shining with waiting. Pa and Cash are coming down the hill, but Jewel is going to the barn. Jewel, Pa says. Jewel does not stop. Where you going? Pa says. But Jewel does not stop. You leave that horse here, Pa says. Jewel stops and looks at Pa. Jewel's eyes look like marbles. You leave that horse here, Pa says. We'll all go in the wagon with Ma like she wanted. But my mother is a fish. Vernon seen it. He was there. Jewel's mother is a horse, Dahl said. Then mine can be a fish, can it, Dahl? I said. Jewel is my brother. Then mine will have to be a horse, too, I said. Why? Dahl said. If Pa's your Pa, why does your Ma have to be a horse just because Jules is? Why does it? I said. Why does it, Dahl? Dahl is my brother. Then what is your Ma, Dahl? I said. I haven't got ear one, Dahl said. Because if I had one, it is was. And if it is was, it can't be is, can it? No, I said. Then I am not, Dahl said. Am I? No, I said. I am. Dahl is my brother. But you are, Dahl, I said. I know it, Dahl said. That's why I am not is. Are is too many for one woman to fold. Cash is carrying his toolbox. Pa looks at him. I'll stop at Toll's on the way back, Cash says. Get on that barn roof. It ain't respectful, Pa says. It's a deliberate flouting of her and of me. Do you want him to come all the way back here and carry them up to Toll's afoot? Dahl says. Pa looks at Dahl, his mouth chewing. Pa shaves every day now because my mother is a fish. It ain't right, Pa says. Dewey Dell has the package in her hand. She has the basket with our dinner, too. What's that? Pa says. Mrs. Tull's cakes, Dewey Dell says, getting into the wagon. I'm taking them to town for her. It ain't right, Pa says. It's a flouting of the dead. It'll be there. It'll be there come Christmas, she says, shining on the track. She says he won't sell it to no town boys.
Dahl. He goes on toward the barn, entering the lot, wooden-backed. Dewey Dell carries the basket on one arm, in the other hand something wrapped square in a newspaper. Her face is calm and sullen, her eyes brooding and alert. Within them, I can see Peabody's back like two round peas in two thimbles. Perhaps in Peabody's back, two of those worms which work surreptitious and steady through you and out the other side, and you waking suddenly from sleep or from waking, with on your face an expression sudden, intent, and concerned. She sets the basket into the wagon and climbs in, her leg coming long from beneath her tightening dress, that lever which moves the world, one of that caliper which measures the length and breadth of life. She sits on the seat beside Vardaman and sets the parcel on her lap. Then he enters the barn. He has not looked back.
"It ain't right," Pa says. "It's little enough for him to do for her."
"Go on," Cash says. "Leave him stay if he wants. He'll be all right here. Maybe he'll go up to Tull's and stay."
"He'll catch us," I say. "He'll cut across and meet us at Tull's Lane."
"He would have rid that horse, too," Pa says, "if I hadn't have stopped him. A dern spotted critter wilder than a catamount. A deliberate flouting of her and of me."
The wagon moves. The mule's ears begin to bob. Behind us, above the house, motionless in tall and soaring circles, they diminish and disappear.
Ants. I told him not to bring that horse out of respect for his dead ma, because it wouldn't look right, him prancing along on a dern circus animal, and her wanting us all to be in the wagon with her that sprung from her flesh and blood. But we hadn't no more than passed Tull's Lane when Dahl began to laugh. Sitting back there on the plank seat with Cash, with his dead ma laying in her coffin at his feet, laughing. How many times I told him it's doing such things as that that makes folks talk about him, I don't know. I says I got some regard for what folks says about my flesh and blood, even if you haven't. Even if I have raised such a darn passel of boys. And when you fixes it so folks can say such about you, it's a reflection on your ma, I says, not me. I am a man, and I can stand it. It's on your women folks, your ma and sister, that you should care for. And I turned and looked back at him, and him sitting there laughing. I don't expect you to have no respect for me, I says, but with your own ma not cold in her coffin yet. Yonder, Cash says, jerking his head toward the lane. The horse is still a right smart piece away, coming up at a good pace, but I don't have to be told who it is. I just looked back at Dahl, sitting there laughing. I done my best, I says. I tried to do as she would wish it. The Lord will pardon me and excuse the conduct of them he sent me. And Dahl, sitting on the plank seat right above her, where she was laying, laughing.
Dahl. He comes up the lane fast, yet we are 300 yards beyond the mouth of it when he turns into the road, the mud flying beneath the flicking drive of the hooves. Then he slows a little, light and erect in the saddle, the horse mincing through the mud. Tull is in his lot. He looks at us, lifts his hand. We go on, the wagon creaking, the mud whispering on the wheels. Vernon still stands there. He watches Jewel as he passes, the horse moving with a light, high-kneed driving gait 300 yards back. We go on, with a motion so soporific, so dreamlike, as to be uninferent of progress, as though time and not space were decreasing between us and it. It turns off at right angles. The wheel marks of last Sunday healed away now, a smooth red scoriation curving away into the pines, a white signboard with faded lettering. New Hope Church, 3MI. It wheels up like a motionless hand lifted above the profound desolation of the ocean. Beyond it, the red road lies like a spoke of which Addie Bundren is the rim. It wheels past, empty, unscarred. The white signboard turns away its fading and tranquil assertion. Cash looks up the road quietly, his head turning as we pass it, like an owl's head, his face composed. Pa looks straight ahead, humped. Dewey Dell looks at the road, too. Then she looks back at me, her eyes watchful and repudiant. Not like that question which was in those of Cash, for a smoldering while. The signboard passes. The unscarred road wheels on. Then Dewey Dell turns her head. The wagon creaks on. Cash spits over the wheel. In a couple of days now, it'll be smelling, he says. You might tell Jewel that, I say. He is motionless now, sitting the horse at the junction, upright, watching us, no less still than the signboard that lifts its fading capitulation opposite him. It ain't balanced right for no long ride, Cash says. Tell him that too, I say. The wagon creaks on. A mile further along, he passes us, the horse, arch-necked, reined back to a swift single foot. He sits lightly, poised, upright, wooden-faced in the saddle, the broken hat raked at a swaggering angle. He passes us swiftly, without looking at us, the horse driving, its hooves hissing in the mud. A gout of mud, backflung, plops onto the box. Cash leans forward and takes a tool from his box and removes it carefully. When the road crosses Whiteleaf, the willows leaning near enough, he breaks off a branch and scours at the stain with the wet leaves.
Ants. It's a hard country on man. It's hard. 8 miles of the sweat of his body washed up out in the Lord's earth, where the Lord himself told him to put it. Nowhere in this sinful world can a honest, hard-working man profit. It takes them that runs the stores in the towns, doing no sweating, living off of them that sweats. It ain't the hard-working man, the farmer. Sometimes I wonder why we keep at it. It's because there is a reward for us above, where they can't take their autos and such. Every man will be equal there, and it will be taken from them that have, and give to them that have not by the Lord. But it's a long wait, seems like. It's bad that a fellow must earn the reward of his right doing by flouting himself in his dead. We drove all the rest of the day and got to Samson's at dusk dark, and then that bridge was gone too. They hadn't never seen the river so high, and it had not done raining yet. There was old men that hadn't never seen nor hear of it being so in the memory of man. I am the chosen of the Lord, for who he loveth, so doeth he chastiseth. But I be dern if he don't take some curious ways to show it, seems like. But now I can get them teeth. That will be a comfort. It will. Samson. It was just before sundown. We were sitting on the porch when the wagon came up the road with the five of them in it, and the other one on the horse behind. One of them raised his hand, but they was going on past the store without stopping. "Who's that?" McCallum says. I can't think of his name. Rafe's twin, that one it was. "It's Bundren from down beyond New Hope," Quick says. "There's one of them Snopes horses Jules riding." "I didn't know there was e'er one of them horses left," McCallum says. "I thought you folks down there finally contrived to give them all away." "Try and get that one," Quick says. The wagon went on. "I bet old man Lon never gave it to him," I says.
No, Quick says. He bought it from Pappy.
The wagon went on.
They must not have heard about the bridge, he says. What are they doing up here anyway? McCallum says. Taking a holiday since he got his wife buried, I reckon, Quick says. Heading for town, I reckon, with Tull's bridge gone, too. I wonder if they ain't heard about the bridge.
They'll have to fly, then, I says. I don't reckon there's e'er a bridge between here and mouth of Ishitawa. They had something in the wagon. But Quick had been to the funeral 3 days ago, and we naturally never thought anything about it except that they were heading away from home mighty late, and that they hadn't heard about the bridge.
You better holler at them, McCallum says.
Dern it, the name is right on the tip of my tongue. So Quick hollered, and they stopped, and he went to the wagon and told them. He come back with them.
They're going to Jefferson, he says. The bridge at Tull's is gone, too.
Like we didn't know it. And his face looked funny, around the nostrils. But they just sat there, Bundren and the girl and the chap on the seat, and Cash and the second one, the one folks talks about, on a plank across the tailgate, and the other one on that spotted horse. But I reckon they was used to it by then, because when I said to Cash that they'd have to pass by New Hope again, and what they'd better do, he just says, I reckon we can get there. I ain't much for meddling. Let every man run his own business to suit himself, I say. But after I talked to Rachel about them not having a regular man to fix her, and it being July and all, I went back down to the barn and tried to talk to Bundren about it. I give her my promise, he says. Her mind was set on it. I notice how it takes a lazy man, a man that hates moving, to get set on moving once he does get started off, the same as he was set on staying still, like it ain't the moving he hates so much as the starting and the stopping, and like he would be kind of proud of whatever come up to make the moving or the setting still look hard. He sat there on the wagon, hunched up, blinking, listened to us tell about how quick the bridge went and how high the water was, and I'd be darned if he didn't act like he was proud of it, like he had made the river rise himself. You say it's higher than you ever see it before, he says. God's will be done, he says. I reckon it won't go down much by morning neither, he says. You better stay here tonight, I says, and get an early start for New Hope tomorrow morning. I was just sorry for them bone-gaunted mules. I told Rachel, I says, well, would you have had me turn them away at dark 8 miles from home? What else could I do, I says. It won't be but one night, and they'll keep it in the barn, and they'll surely get started by daylight. And so I says, you stay here tonight, and early tomorrow you can go back to New Hope. I got tools enough, and the boys can go on right after supper and have it dug and ready if they want. And then I found that girl watching me. If her eyes had been pistols, I wouldn't be talking now. I'd be dog if they didn't blaze at me. And so when I went down to the barn, I come on them, her talking so she never noticed when I come up. You promised her, she says. She wouldn't go until you promised. She thought she could depend on you. If you don't do it, it will be a curse on you. Can't no man say I don't aim to keep my word, Bundren says. My heart is open to e'er man. I don't care what your heart is, she says. She was whispering, kind of, talking fast. You promised her. You've got to. You... Then she seen me and quit, standing there. If they'd been pistols, I wouldn't be talking now. So when I talk to him about it, he says, I give her my promise. Her mind is set on it. but seems to me she'd rather have her ma buried close by so she could... It's Addie I give the promise to, he says. Her mind is set on it. So I told them to drive it into the barn, because it was threatening rain again, and that supper was about ready. Only they didn't want to come in. I thank you, Bundren says. We wouldn't discommode you. We got a little something in the basket we can make out. Well, I says, since you are so particular about your women folks, I am too. And when folks stops with us at mealtime and won't come to the table, my wife takes it as an insult. So the girl went on to the kitchen to help Rachel. And then Jewel come to me. Sure, I says, help yourself out in the loft. Feed him when you bait the mules. I rather pay you for him, he says. What for, I says. I wouldn't begrudge no man a bait for his horse. I rather pay you, he says. I thought he said extra. Extra for what, I says. Won't he eat hay and corn? Extra feed, he says. I feed him a little extra, and I don't want him beholden to no man. You can't buy no feed for me, boy, I says. And if he can eat that loft clean, I'll help you load the barn onto the wagon in the morning. He ain't never been beholden to no man, he says. I'd rather pay you for it. And if I had my rathers, you wouldn't be here at all, I wanted to say. But I just says, then it's high time he commenced. You can't buy no feed for me. When Rachel put supper on, her and the girl went and fixed some beds. But wouldn't any of them come in? She's been dead long enough to get over that sort of foolishness, I says. Because I got just as much respect for the dead as air man. But you've got to respect the dead themselves. And a woman that's been dead in a box 4 days, the best way to respect her is to get her into the ground as quick as you can. But they wouldn't do it. It wouldn't be right, Bundren says. Course, if the boys want to go to bed, I reckon I can set up with her. I don't begrudge her it. So when I went back down there, they were squatting on the ground around the wagon, all of them. Let that chap come to the house and get some sleep anyway, I says. And you better come too, I says to the girl. I wasn't aiming to interfere with them, and I surely hadn't done nothing to her that I knowed. He's done already asleep, Bundren says. They had done put him to bed in the trough in an empty stall. Well, you come on then, I says to her. But still, she never said nothing. They just squatted there. You couldn't hardly see them. How about you boys, I says. You got a full day tomorrow. After a while, Cash says, I thank you. We can make out. We wouldn't be beholden, Bundren says. I thank you kindly. So I left them squatting there. I reckon after 4 days they was used to it. But Rachel wasn't. It's a outrage, she says. A outrage. What could he have done, I says. He give her his promised word. Who's talking about him, she says. Who cares about him, she says, crying. I just wish that you and him and all the men in the world that torture us alive and flout us dead, dragging us up and down the country. Now, now, I says, you're upset. Don't you touch me, she says. Don't you touch me. A man can't tell nothing about them. I lived with the same one 15 years, and I'd be durned if I can. And I imagined a lot of things coming up between us. But I'd be darned if I ever thought it would be a body 4 days dead, and that a woman. But they make life hard on them, not taking it as it comes up, like a man does. So I laid there, hearing it commence to rain,
thinking about them down there, squatting around the wagon and the rain on the roof, and thinking about Rachel crying there until after a while it was like I could still hear her crying even after she was asleep, and smelling it even when I knowed I couldn't. I couldn't decide even then whether I could or not, or if it wasn't just knowing it was what it was. So next morning I never went down there. I heard them hitching up, and then when I knowed they must be about ready to take out, I went out the front and went down the road toward the bridge until I heard the wagon come out of the lot and go back toward New Hope. And then when I come back to the house, Rachel jumped on me because I wasn't there to make them come in to breakfast. You can't tell about them. Just about when you decide they mean one thing, I'd be darned if you not only haven't got to change your mind, like as not you got to take a rawhiding for thinking they meant it. But it was still like I could smell it. And so I decided then that it wasn't smelling it, but it was just knowing it was there. Like you will get fooled now and then. But when I went to the barn, I knew different. When I walked into the hallway, I saw something. It kind of hunkered up when I come in, and I thought at first it was one of them got left. Then I saw what it was. It was a buzzard. It looked around me and saw me and went on down the hall, spraddle-legged, with its wings kind of hunkered out, watching me first over one shoulder and then over the other, like an old, bald-headed man. When it got outdoors, it begun to fly. It had to fly a long time before it ever got up into the air, with it thick and heavy and full of rain like it was. If they was bent on going to Jefferson, I reckon they could have gone around up by Mount Vernon, like McCallum did. He'll get home about day after tomorrow, horseback. Then they'd be just 18 miles from town. But maybe this bridge being gone, too, has learned him the Lord's sense and judgment. That McCallum. He's been trading with me off and on for 12 years. I've known him from a boy up. Know his name as well as I do my own. But be darned if I can say it.
Dewey Dell. The signboard comes in sight. It is looking out at the road now, because it can wait. New Hope, 3 mi, it will say. New Hope, 3 mi. New Hope, 3 mi. And then the road will begin, curving away into the trees, empty with waiting, saying New Hope, 3 miles. I heard that my mother is dead. I wish I had time to let her die. I wish I had time to wish I had. It is because in the wild and outraged earth, too soon, too soon, too soon. It's not that I wouldn't and will not. It's that it is too soon, too soon, too soon. Now it begins to say it. New Hope, 3 miles. New Hope, 3 miles. That's what they mean by the womb of time, the agony and the despair of spreading bones, the hard girdle in which lie the outraged entrails of events. Cash's head turns slowly as we approach, his pale, empty, sad, composed, and questioning face following the red and empty curve. Beside the back wheel, Jewel sits on the horse, gazing straight ahead. The land runs out of Darl's eyes. They swim to pinpoints. They begin at my feet and rise along my body to my face. And then my dress is gone. I sit naked on the seat above the unhurrying mules, above the travail. Suppose I tell him to turn. He will do what I say. Don't you know he will do what I say? Once I waked with a black void rushing under me. I could not see. I saw Vardaman rise and go to the window and strike the knife into the fish, the blood gushing, hissing.